This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Vayadaber Hashem el Moshe le'emor, Hashem says to Moshe saying, Nekoim nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'is hamidyonim, achat he'osef el amecho. Take revenge, avenge on behalf of B'nai Yisrael from the Midianites, and then you will die. Vayadaber Moshe el ha'om le'emor, Moshe spoke to the people saying, Heicholtzu me'itchem anoshim la'tzovo, organize yourselves men for the army, v'yiyu al Midyon, and set them upon Midyon, loses nikmas Hashem b'Midyon, to avenge the avenge of Hashem from Midyon. Asks Rashi, and the Medrash also, Hashem says, you're avenging on behalf of the of B'nai Yisrael. And Moshe says, you're avenging on behalf of Hashem. Hashem says, Nikmas B'nai Yisrael me'is hamidyonim. Go and avenge on behalf of the Jewish people. And Moshe says, V'yu hamidyon loses nikmas Hashem, to avenge for Hashem, on behalf of Hashem. Says the Medrash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omar Nikmas B'nai Yisrael, U'Moshe Omar Nikmas Hashem. God says, go and get the avenge of the Jewish people, and Moshe says, the avenge of God. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lehem. Said Hashem to the B'nai Yisrael, Einoi Elo Deika Sholochem. You're going to avenge your own, it's your business really. She'gormu li lahazik eschem. They made me damage you. They caused you to sin, they caused you to be over averus, and they caused me to have to punish you. So you go and get them now. Omar Moshe says, one minute, Ribbono Elohim, im hayinu areilim, if we were uncircumcised, if we served idols like they do, so if we didn't believe in the mitzvahs, would they hate us? No, you so ni misona, we would be like them. They don't hate each other, they wouldn't hate us. Vein and roitfim acharenu, they wouldn't pursue us. The reason they do it, the reason they hate us, is for the Torah and the mitzvahs that you gave us. Therefore, it's Hashem's nekoma, it's Hashem's avenge, not ours, not our business. We're doing it on your behalf, not on our own behalf. The only reason they hate us in the first place is because we are servants of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so, what we're dealing with here is really some of the fundamental causes of anti-Semitism. What is it? What is it that they hate? What is it that they persecute? What is it that the generation after generation, for centuries and centuries and centuries, what is it about the Jewish people that has caused so much hatred, so much sino among so many of the non-Jewish nations? And what does it mean? And Rashi summarizes it by saying, Nikmas Hashem sheha'imed keneged Yisrael, ki'ilu oimed keneged HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because those who stand up against Yisrael are in fact standing up against the Ribbono Shel Olam. What does it mean? Is anti-Semitism really against the Jewish people, or is it against the Ribbono Shel Olam? Rashi says it the same thing. The Medrash learns it. It's not so clear. God says they're against you. And Moshe says they're not. They're only against us because we're doing your mitzvahs. That's where it is. So there's a little bit of confusion about it. And what we're going to do to start with is go over a medrash that I learned with the ladies this morning in the Megillas Esther shiur. The medrash, it's an absolutely fascinating medrash. It's a study in anti-Semitism. And in fact, as we learned, and as you'll see, it is the model for anti-Semitism. In that the Medrash brings the precise wording of the decree that was sent out by Ahasuerus to all his states to destroy the Jewish people. The Medrash actually brings in the Megillah, we're not told any details about it. In the Megillah, all we're told is that Ahasuerus sent out a decree to wipe out the Jewish people on the 13th of Adar of the following year. But the Medrash actually brings the full wording of the decree. How Ahasuerus sold the idea to the 120 nations that he governed. V'chein kosvu bo'isun igris. says the Medrash. And this is what was written in those letters and those decrees that were sent out. Shalom lechem adein chekim. Starts every word of the letter. Opening line. Shalom, peace to you without limits. And this is how he proceeds. Yodea lochem, it needs to be known to you, she'odom echod yesh beinenu v'loy mim kameinu hu. There is a man who sits in our cabinet who is not one of us, who does not come from our land. Elo mizera hamaluchahu, but he is of royal descent, very important man. Mizera shel Amalek, he in fact is descended from Amalek. U'migdoyle hadorhu, and is one of the greatest people of the generation. V'homon shmo, and his name is Homon. V'sho'al mimenu she'elok tano v'kalo al am echod asher yesh beinenu. And this important man, Homon, has asked us, the king, for some small favor which is rather easy to execute, concerning a particular nation who lives among us, Nivze mikol ho'amim, who is cheaper than any of the nations, v'da'atom gaso aleihim, yet they have become arrogant, chafetzim b'roseinu, and they want to destroy us. V'kilulas ha'melech sheguru b'fihim, they are accustomed to curse the king, u'ma'u ha'klolo she'mekalalim o'yisodu. And if you want to see the curse that they pronounce for the king, don't think I'm talking nonsense. Refer to Tehillim chapter 10. And you'll see what's written in their Bible. Hashem belech olam v'ed ovdu goyim me'artzo. Hashem, king forever, destroy the nations from his land. So you see that they don't like us. V'odoyim rim, and if you look at Tehillim chapter 149, there you'll see it says, La'asos mekom abagoyim techechus balumim. They pray to Hashem, they pray to their God, that he should avenge the nations and rebuke the peoples. V'chofrim, but more than that, so not only is the first thing you need to know, explains Achashverosh, is that they're our enemies. Don't think that they're nice just because they smile at you every morning and they greet you on their way in and they work nicely for you and you deal with them. You need to know what goes on when they're on their own behind closed doors in their shuls. You want to know what they're saying and what they're davening about. Look inside. I'll refer you to their own sidurim. I'll refer you to their own tehillim. You'll see what they say. So you need to know what they're saying behind those closed doors about us. They're no friends of ours. That's the first thing you need to know. True or untrue? It's true. I'm not saying anything false. It's true. But worse than that, Achashverosh, in this masterpiece of literature, of anti-Semitic literature, the chayfrim b'misha also lehem tovel. But worse than that, they have no moral standing whatever, because the bottom line of any kind of morality is to acknowledge gratitude, to acknowledge indebtedness. If someone does something for you, you've got to feel indebted and you've got to respond. If you don't have that, there's nothing. There's no menschlichkeit. There's nothing. These people don't even have the most basic level of menschlichkeit. Nothing. And I'll prove that to you as well. This is not just personal feelings. I'll show this to you. Look at their history. Look at that poor fellow Paro, what they did to him. See what he's doing now? By just adding in the word that poor Paro, he's beginning to play on sympathies. He sounds like the American media. What happened when they came to Egypt? Consult the history books. Did Paro throw them out? Did he lock them in concentration camps? Kiblom b'sever ponim yofus. He accepted them, he welcomed them with an open, happy face. V'hishivom b'meitav ha'oretz. He gave them the best part of Egypt. V'zonoisom b'shnei re'ovon. And when the whole world was going through recession, and the whole world was going through hunger, he fed them. He gave them food. V'echilom kol tuv shebe'atzo. He gave them food from the best in their land. They didn't suffer anything during that terrible recession, during those 7 years of famine when people were so hungry. The Jewish people didn't suffer at all. Paro looked after them. Pauterin hayulu livnos. He had palaces to build. He had buildings to build. Who did he give the work to? Do you think he just took his own labor? People were desperate for work at that time. He didn't take his own labor. V'hayu bonim shom. He gave the contracts to the Jewish contractors to do. Employed the Jews to do the job. Unbelievable man, this Paroh. But don't think that all that kindness gave him any kind of status in their minds and gave him any authority with him. Not only did it not give him any status in their minds and any authority over them, but they dealt with him so cunningly after all that good. Look how cunningly they dealt with him. Vomrulo, refer to their Bible, Exodus chapter 5, and you'll see it. They said to Paro, Lizboach la'ashem elokeinu nelech derech shloshis yomim v'achakach noshuv. We want to go for 3 days to serve our God, and we'll be back again afterwards. That's all, just 3 days we want to go. Please give us the time off. And I suppose Paro wanted to adopt a policy of no work, no pay. But no, they didn't even want that. They said further, in return for, and if you don't mind, Paro, they said, you know, we're going to celebrate, and it's the first time we've done this, and we don't really have very much. Hash'ileinu klei kesef, can you lend us? You know, we need silverware. What are we going to put on our tables at the celebration? We need nice cutlery. Have you got silverware that you can lend us? The klei zohov. Maybe you've got some gold platters and things that we can put on the table as well. You know, we don't want it to look umedik there. This is after all our God. We want to make it look nice. We can perhaps borrow some gold from you. Usamolos, and we don't want to go in our working overalls. Perhaps we can borrow some nice Egyptian clothing. Vihishilu. And Paro lent them kaspom, uzahavom, their silver and their gold, v'chol habegodim hatovim shalohem, and the best of Egyptian clothing he let them have. V'toanu kol echod kama chamorim shalohem le'im lispa. And each Jew was able to load several donkeys of wares taken from Paro, from Mitzrayim, so that they could go for these 3 days and celebrate their Yom Tov in an honorable way. Ad shemitzvus Mitzrayim. So much so that it was the point of taking advantage already of Egypt. It went too far. They were taking advantage of Paro's generosity. And it's not me, Achashverosh, who says that. Not me. I'm not interpreting. I'm just giving you the facts. Refer to Exodus chapter 12. And there you'll see it says in their own Torah, by Yenatzluis Mitzrayim. They took advantage of the Egyptians. See it? I'm just reporting facts. But then what did they do after the 3 days? Do you think they came back? They took the gold and the silver and the clothes and they ran for it. It was all a trick. It was theft. Paro heard that they were fleeing. He didn't mind that they wanted to emigrate. That was no problem. They can go whenever they wanted. But what about the money? Look what he's given them. He fled after them. For what reason? Just to get his money back. That's all he wanted. He didn't want to kill them. He didn't want to harm them. He just wanted his money back, poor old Paro. What did they do? They had among them a fellow, Ushmo Moshe ben Amram. His name was Moshe ben Amram. Uvikshofov notar makel echod, and he was a wizard. And using his witchcraft, he took a certain stick, the lachasholov, and he performed some witchcraft on the stick. Vehiko boiz hayom, and he hit the sea, ad shenecherav, until the sea dried up. Venichmasu kulam bayaboshov betoy hayom, and they all walked into the sea on dry land. Vovru kulam, and they all passed through the sea. And I cannot explain to you how they did it. All I know is that it happened. How they did it? They seem to have some secret weapon. As I explained this morning, the most fearful thing is to talk about a secret weapon. You can talk about any weapon you like. If the enemy understands the weapon, they can come to terms with it and they can work out their defenses. But when you talk about secret weapons, that makes people very scared. And so his working already on their fears. I can't tell you how they did it, but they did it. There's some secret weapon they possess. Kivan Shiro Paru, when Paru saw that the sea had dried up and he wanted his money back for his people, Nichnas Achareim, he pursued after them, Lachaziris Mamonis, says to get his money back. Ve'eni Yodea Bame Dechofu Besoy Chayom, I don't know how they did it, but they pushed him back into the sea, Ve'nitbahu Vechol Chelo Bayom. And he and his entire army drowned in the sea. And those Jews didn't even remember all the goodness that Paro had done to them. Just killed him in cold blood, him and his whole army. All he wanted was his money back. And they destroyed the entire Egyptian people. So you see, they don't understand gratitude. No matter how good you are to them, it doesn't help a thing. They'll wait for their opportunity, and they'll take advantage, and they'll destroy us. Is there anything inaccurate in Achashverosh's report of events? Nothing at all. It's absolutely true. It's interesting to see the other side of the story sometimes, isn't it? V'oid, me osu la'amolik, avi abo. What did they do to my grandpa Amalek? L'shor shabar le'im le'milchama, when he came to fight with him. What happened there? What was all that background about? Shenema vayovei amolek vayilochim b'misroel b'refidim. Look in their Torah. And you'll see there it says, Exodus chapter 17, that Amalek came to do battle with him. Why did Amalek come to do battle with him? What got into his head? What was it all about? What did it bother him? How am I going to understand my ancestors' motivation in going out to war with these people? What was that? Umehechin bo Amalek, where did he come from? Omer Rabbi Krus B'doi, Vayova Amalek, B'shem Rabbi Yechonon, Shebo Me'etzo Bilam HaRoshim. He had just come from a consultation with Bilam. Said to him, Amalek said to Bilam, I know that you give good advice. And you also know how to be evil. And that whoever takes advice from you doesn't come unstuck. I know that you have that reputation. Amalek said to Amalek, have a look and see what this nation did to Egypt. She also learned Kamatovis. Look how many good things Egypt did for them. And what they did to Egypt in the end. Umal Mitzrayim, she also learned Kamatovis. Also learned Kach. So Amalek makes a Kalvachobe. If to Egypt, to whom they owed so much gratitude, what did they do? They destroyed every single one of them. Lisha'aru Moisalachas Kamatovis. What do you think they're going to do to us? What are they going to do? They want to dominate the world. This is world domination they're after. They had no reason to go against Egypt. On the contrary, they owed Egypt their lives. And if that's what they did to a nation to whom they owed their lives, what do you think they're going to do to us? Heichato yatani, what should we do? Amale Bilam. Bilam says to him, Lech vaseimai milchono. You become the aggressor. You declare war. Don't wait for them to come to you, because then you'll be in trouble. You go out and declare war. And if you do that, you'll win. Why? You know what their secret weapon is? They descended from Avram. That's where all their power comes from. Avram was a tzaddik, and they have the power of Avram they have with them. That you, Amalek, have an advantage that none of the rest of us have, and nor did Mitzrayim have. You descended from Avram too. You're also a grandson of Avram. You come from Esav. And Esav's grandfather was Avram, just as Yaakov's grandfather was Avram. So you have as much, you will draw as much power from Avram as they do. Avram likes his two grandchildren equally, I'm sure, and you won't find that they have anything over you. You go and declare war on them. Miyad bo aleim lemilchomo, so he went out to war. Again, interesting to know the background. We, from our perspective, just see Amalek, without reason, attacking us. What caused him to attack? We don't know. We don't get into that. But when you see the story from the other side, it's very interesting. Amalek was petrified. And he believed that the Jews were going to dominate the world. He'd seen what they did to Mitzrayim. And Bilam advised him to go and do war against the Jewish people. And by the way, we're going to have to understand what it was, or why it is that we regard Amalek in such a negative light. If that's why he went to war, it's understandable. If he was afraid, if that's what motivated him into battle, what was so terrible? We'll see. But this isn't the end of Ahasuerus's brilliant masterpiece of anti-Semitic literature. He carries on. Moshe, what did that Moshe do? Hayolo Talmid Echod, he had a certain Talmid. He had a disciple, Moshe. Yoshua bin Nun Shemo, his name was Yoshua bin Nun. V'hoyo achzori admoid. He was an incredibly cruel man. V'lo hoyo lo rachamim, and he had no mercy. Imagine children who brought up with this history, with this perspective on Jewish history. There's this cruel man, Yoshua. Omar Yosef Moshe b'cholo anoshim b'tzeh hilochem ba'amonik. And Moshe instructed this cruel man, Yeshua, to put together an army and to go out against Amalek. I don't know, says Achashverosh, whether he chose wizards or army generals. I don't know if they were very sophisticated soldiers or whether they just had mastered witchcraft. But Moshe, and what did that Moshe do? Not Amakel Biyodah, that stick he took in his hand again. I don't know what he did with that stick. But kiven sheboa aleim in yodea melocha shaleim v'rofu yodeim v'nofu lifneim. I don't know what happened, what he did, what witchcraft did. All I know is that this powerful nation Amalek with this wonderful army attacked this band of exiled slaves, and they just weakened at the knees. They couldn't do anything. Amalek was just weak. I don't know how they did it, but they did it. And don't think I'm giving you my own interpretation, says Achashverosh. Refer once again to Exodus chapter 17, where you'll see it says, Vayachalosh Yoshua es Amalek ves Amoy lefi chorif. That Yoshua and his people weakened Amalek and his people. That Yoshua weakened Amalek and his people by the mouth of the sword. So you see, he weakened them. He did something to make them weak. Some kind of secret weapon they've got. I don't know what it is. I don't understand it, but they've got it. And he goes on. Then they attacked Sichon and Oig that no other creature had ever been able to conquer. And I don't know how, but they killed them. They came upon the kings of Midian. I don't know how they did it, but they killed them too. What did that cruel Talmud of Moshe still do further? He took the Jewish people into the land of Canaan. Not only did he steal the land of Canaan from them, he killed 31 kings in the process. The chilek is out from the Israel, and he chopped up the land and dished it out to the Jewish people. And he didn't show any mercy whatever. And those that he didn't want to kill, he took as slaves. Boaleim Sisra, says Sisra attacked. Bahamina and his multitudes of armies. See, in Judges chapter 5, it's not me, I'm just reporting facts to you. Magically, the Nachakishon came and washed them away and dumped them into the sea. How or what? I don't know how, but it happened. And it's happening just too often, says Achashverosh. And they had a king, their first king's name was Shaul. And he declared war against my grandfather's territory, Amalek. And they killed 100,000 infantry men on one day. And they showed no mercy to man, woman, or child. I don't know how they did it, but they wiped the lot out. And what about my grandfather Agag? In the beginning they showed him a bit of mercy. At the end a certain man came, his name was Shmuel. He chopped my grandpa up into pieces and gave his flesh to the birds of the heaven. Not me, I'm not saying it. Refer to Samuel 1 chapter 15, and there you'll see it tells you that Shmuel came and he chopped Agag up. And this went on. After that they had a king whose name was David. He just devastated all the kingdoms. And he showed no mercy. Shenema, as it says, 1 Samuel 1:27, don't take my word for it. The ish v'isho lo yichay David. And David didn't leave a man or a woman alive. See what kind of people we're dealing with. V'omad achor of Shlomo b'noi, and then as his son Shlomo became king, uvono lo'im li'Yisrael bayis echod, v'koro lo'i beis hamikdash. And Shlomo built them a building, and he called it beis hamikdash. V'eini yodea mehoyo lo'im b'seicha. I don't know what was inside that beis hamikdash. It was very secret, you could never get inside. But what I do know is that before a war, they used to go into this building, and they used to do witchcraft inside the building. And when they came out of that building, they had the power to destroy the world. Because of all this goodness they had, they rebelled against their God. Because there's no way we could take on a people like that. They had some kind of divine assistance. But luckily, God got fed up with them. And also, you know, their God was getting old already by now. This thing, how long can this carry on for? This is already centuries, generations. So Nebuchadnezzar was able to conquer them and to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It's the first time we've had an indication that they no longer have this secret weapon. That's it. It's begun to go. Vehiglo mel admosum ve'evim beinenu Nebuchadnezzar exiled them from their land and brought them to us. But ba'adayim v'yishonu ma'aseyam ha'mechorim. Don't think they've learned their lesson. They haven't changed their ugly ways. V'yafa pishem begolus beinenu. And even though they are exiled as guests among us, mal'igim v'yishonu, they mock us, v'yisemun ha'selukei Eloheinu, and the belief of our gods. V'yachshav iskamnu kulonu l'dea achas v'yipalnu gerolus l'abdu min ha'il. And so the cabinet has taken a unanimous decision now to destroy them totally, to get rid of this people once and for all, and we ask for your assistance in doing so. That is the letter that went out, composed by Haman with Achashverosh's seal to all of the states of the world at that time. And an absolute masterpiece, as we said, a masterpiece of anti-Semitic literature. And the model of all subsequent anti-Semitism. That is the model. Every aspect of anti-Semitism you will find in here. Whether it's a religiously based anti-Semitism, whether it's based on the fact that God has rejected the Jewish people, or that the Jewish people hate the non-Jewish people, or that whatever you want to find, you'll find the source of any anti-Semitic argument. You'll find in that letter that Achashverosh and Haman sent out to those people. That's why Purim is such an important day, because it brings together, it is the absolute crystallization of the conflict between Amalek and the Jewish people. Everything Achashverosh says in that letter is accurate. He's not even interpreting. He's merely recording events. And what he doesn't know, he says, I don't know how they did it, I don't know what power, all I'm reporting is the facts. The fact is, that's what they did. As one of the ladies commented after the ladies' shiur this morning, it's a little bit like advocates in court. Facts, only facts. But the picture that starts emerging from the facts they select can be quite horrific. And the other side then has to try and put these facts into some kind of broader perspective. We are trained to think that from facts you can see the truth. There you go. Achashverosh lays out the facts. And the conclusion from those facts is that this is a highly dangerous nation with no moral scruples whatever, whose God has even abandoned them. And therefore it's time to do away with them. Wonderful argument. Who can argue with that? The facts are there. Good. The facts are there. Everything he says is correct. Everything he says is true. But are there facts that he's omitted that are significant? Because when they make you swear in court, they make you swear not just to tell the truth, but to tell the whole truth. It's not good enough that whatever you say is true. If you skip out one or two points that are also true, that can affect the whole picture. What is it that Achashverosh has left out? He's been very all-encompassing. He's taken us through Jewish history step by step. The only criticism we can have of this piece of literature is its starting point. It starts in the middle of the story. And that's always very, very dangerous, to start in the middle of the story. In order to understand something in perspective, it's necessary to start at the beginning of the story. And the degree of perception and the degree of wisdom with which one approaches an issue depends to a large extent on one's ability to identify when the story really did begin. That's what's important. When did the story begin? And the story of the conflict between Paro and the Jewish people, or never mind the conflict, the story of the interrelationship between the Egyptian people and Jewish people, when did that begin? Did that begin when Yaakov came down with his sons and Paro received him so well? That's when Achashverosh starts the story. That's when Amalek starts the story. That's the brilliance of their portrayal of the story. They choose at what point to start it. The starting point is this poor family comes from Canaan with nothing to eat, and this magnificent Paro opens his land to them with enormous hospitality and generosity and gives them unbelievable privileges, for which they afterwards kick him in the pants. That's how the story develops. And that has been the pattern of their behavior ever since. But the story begins a chapter earlier. They weren't the first ones to come to Egypt. Yosef was the first one to come to Egypt. And who was it who saved the Egyptian people from annihilation? A Jew called Yosef. And if you start the story there, the whole picture is different. Yosef saved the Egyptian people. That was the first thing. So Paro owes something to the Jews. So when the Jews came down, Paro is good to them. Paro is paying his debt. when the Jews are enslaved and they work for Paro, who owes who now? Now it's once again Paro who owes the Jews, and he doesn't give them anything. So they have to be manipulative in order to get their wages, and they borrow their wages and then they go off. That's the only way they're going to get paid for their 70 years of labor. Who owes who? It depends where you start looking, where the game begins. Who struck the first strike? That's what's important. And Ahasuerus starts the story with Paro being the one to open up. Paro opens with a magnanimous gesture of hospitality and generosity, and they don't respond. If we open the story with Yosef, then it's Yosef who saves the people. And we said in a Motzei Shabbos only a few weeks ago how Yosef could have used that information for himself. What Yosef could have done with the knowledge that there was going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Yosef could have acquired the whole of Mitzrayim and the whole of that area of the world for himself. He could have become supreme ruler of the whole civilized world of that time with that knowledge. He could have acquired for himself unlimited wealth, knowing the future markets, knowing what the price of food was going to be for the next 14 years, being able to predict those cycles. And Yosef takes that knowledge, that information, and gives it to Paro. Doesn't sell it to Paro, doesn't bargain. He hands it to Paro on a plate. Yosef didn't know what would happen to him after that. As far as he knew, he might well be dispatched back to the jail from which he'd just been taken out. Thank you for your interpretation. You may now go back to your jail. Yosef didn't know what he was going to get. He didn't use it for bargaining. He gave it to Paro. That's where the story starts. And to start the story a step further, that's anti-Semitism. And it's not just anti-Semitism, that's any form of prejudice. Is to portray a picture that starts where you've selected the picture to start from and doesn't really start from the very beginning. It's a little bit like walking into the Motzei Shabbos here late. You get about as much accuracy of the picture as you do in walking to any situation late. Anything you start late, if you miss the introduction to anything, not only haven't you got a chance of understanding, but you have no chance of not misunderstanding. It is not possible not to misunderstand if one misses the opening. If one misses the opening shot, that's it. You miss everything. That was the brilliance of Paro, of Ahasuerus, in the way he designed this anti-Semitism. And the design of this anti-Semitic approach was Amalek's. It wasn't Ahasuerus'ism, it wasn't Haman's. Amalek starts that in his consultation with Balaam, doesn't he? That's how he starts. Look at these people. If that's what they did to Egypt, to whom they owe so much goodness, what will they do to us? Amalek was the author of the model, of the perfect anti-Semitic model, which has been drawn upon for all these centuries thereafter. That's why there was a mitzvah. Wipe out Amalek. No other nation had to be wiped out. Other nations we fought with, we made peace with, we patched up with, we did business with, we dealt with. There wasn't anti-Semitism. Little arguments with Avimelech, we had some problems. With Paro, we had some problems. Little problems, we sorted them out. There's one nation that we'll never sort out. And not only will we never sort that nation out, but as long as they exist, they will feed their anti-Semitic propaganda to the rest of the world, and there will be violent and virulent anti-Semitism as long as Amalek is active. And Amalek is identified by this argument. By taking Jewish history and starting it where it chooses to start in order to portray the Jewish people as immoral and aggressive. That's what it is. In the whole debate with the Palestinians, where does the discussion start? 1948. Why start in 1948? Why not start in 1940? Why not start in 1933? Why not start in 1800, in 1700, in 1400, in 900? Why not start at the beginning of the era? Why not start before then? Why not start at Bereshis Bara Elohim? If you're really going to start the story and you want to know who the land belongs to, start at the very beginning and go through the history of mankind. Why start halfway through the story? That's the trick. The trick is to choose your starting point and to persuade the world that that's where the story starts. Then you've got it. Then it's easy. From there on, there's no problem. Easy as anything. A man breaks into your house and you tell him to put his hands up. He doesn't, and you shoot him. Where are you going to start the story from? Are you going to start the story from the firing of the shot? Are you going to start the story from the body lying there and you've got a gun in your hand? You're dead if you do. Police come along, they say, what's happened? You say, look, I don't have to tell you what's happened. The facts are before you. A man is lying here with bleeding, dead, and I have a gun in my hand. What do I have to tell you the story? Can't you figure it out for yourselves? You'll hang. That's it. Depends where you start the story. And if you start the story with a break-in, that's a little bit better. It gives you a bit more of a chance. But what happens if the guy who's breaking in is the guy who really owns the house? You stole the house from him and he's trying to get back. He's trying to get it back. That's all. It started a little bit earlier. It's deciding where you start the story that creates the whole picture. That determines where, that puts it in perspective, and that gives the interpretation. Can't start in the middle. That was the brilliance of Amalek, to start the story of Jewish history with Paro and Mitzrayim. That's in this particular letter, but Amalek doesn't always do that. Sometimes he starts a little earlier. And let's go back a little earlier and see what happens if we go back earlier. How did Yosef land up in Egypt? If we go back, it's all very well saying, we've got to start, the first shot is when Yosef arrives in Egypt and saves Paro. But how did Yosef arrive in Egypt? By the way, before we even go, just as an aside, that's what Potiphar's wife did, isn't it? Just started the story in the middle. Didn't start at the beginning. And look how Yosef comes out looking like the wicked man. If she would just have told the story from the beginning, it would have been clear who was the wicked person. So it's a brilliant technique. Just choose where you want to start the story. And you should try it with all well-known stories. Try and see how the story changes by chopping off the first parts of it and starting the story further and further into the story. See what happens. If we go a little earlier, Yosef comes to Egypt because he was sold to Egypt by his brothers. And that's where anti-Semitism really starts. Because you'll find that argument has been used over and over again. Look what they did to their brother. Look what they did to Yosef. Look how cruel they are. And is that so? Let's analyze for a moment. Their brothers decided to kill Yosef. And then they backed down on it and they decided to sell Yosef. Why? Because the brothers had realized an interesting thing was happening, was developing in Jewish history. Avram had a Bechor, had a firstborn. His name was Ishmael. It wasn't his Bechor who succeeded him. It was Yitzchak. Yitzchak had a Bechor. It wasn't the Bechor who succeeded him. With connivance, if you want to look at it that way, Yaakov becomes the younger one, becomes the heir. Now we have a situation here where Reuven is the Bechor and Yosef is one of the youngsters. And by his conniving, by the way, he's already working to alienate ourselves from our father and our father from ourselves, we can see what's happening. He's going to be the heir and we're going to be disinherited. And as we learnt when we had the Chumash Shir last year, we went through it in great detail, to see how they developed that viewpoint and how they couldn't but come to that conclusion. And on the basis of that, they sat down and decided, lahalocha, what could they do? And they tried to get away from Yosef, and they tried to run away from Yosef. They tried everything first, we'll remember. And when nothing else worked, so we've got to get rid of him. Our spiritual future is at stake. If we don't get rid of this man, he's a fraud. We don't believe his dreams are genuine. And there were reasons why they didn't believe the dreams were genuine. We believe it's all his conniving to try and get his father to disinherit us. That's what it's about. So we have to get rid of him. That's a decision they took. Was that decision... There are two questions we're going to ask. Question number one, was that decision correct? Question number two, was that decision based on a true perception or on a perception of the truth? The answer to the first question is yes, that decision was correct. They took that decision halakhically, that decision was correct. The answer to the second question, was it based on a true perception? No, it wasn't. Because in fact Yosef's dreams were true. And in fact Yosef was a Navi and everything he said was correct and he wasn't planning to disinherit them. So their feelings, their perceptions, their visions on which they based everything were wrong. But the halakhic facts on which they based it were right. And it can happen sometimes, it can happen that a Beis Din pass a sentence on somebody using the correct halakhic criteria and it can be wrong. It's the halakhic decision is correct. A court can decide to sentence a person to death. And later it can emerge the person didn't do the crime. But that doesn't invalidate the sentence. If they followed the halakhic principles all the way through and they were qualified and competent people in the cross-examination of the witnesses, if everything was done halakhically, then that was Hashem's will. That's how he wanted it done. Even though, objectively, the event did not take place. Same here. Hashem wanted all this to take place, even though it was based on events which didn't happen. But this decision of the brothers to kill Yosef and later to sell him was the first decision that the Jewish people took that was not by direct instruction from Hashem, the first major decision, the first decision that affected their future, that was not a decision instigated by Nevuah, by prophecy. Everything else that had been done up until that point was instigated by prophecy. Avram marrying Hagar, that was by prophecy. Avram disinheriting Ishmael, that was by prophecy. Yaakov getting the Bechira from Esau, that was by prophecy. Everything that had happened up till now had been by prophecy. Yaakov's marrying Leah, he really chose to marry Rachel. It worked out that he married Leah despite his best intention. Everything that had happened was Bashir, up until that point. This was the first decision that they took using their own intellects, coming to their own conclusions. There was no Nebuah, Hashem didn't tell them to do it. They decided using their own minds that this was the will of Hashem. So this is the first event which is open to some kind of interpretation. Were they absolutely objective? Was there any tinge of jealousy? Was there any subjective feeling? Was there any anger within themselves? Or were they absolute tzaddikim who acted on absolute objective standards? That's the issue. Because if there was the slightest bit of subjective feeling, they had no right to take that decision. Even if 99.99% of it was objective. If 0.001% of it was subjective, they weren't permitted to take that decision. And who decides? Who's going to take that decision? Was it? Wasn't it? Yosef decides. And Yosef says to them later on, it wasn't you who sent us here. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam who sent me here. Don't worry. That's how God wanted it. I'm here to save you. I'm here to save the family. I'm here to provide for you. It's clear that it was all Hashgacha. I don't hold anything against you. It was clearly Hashem's decision. In that case, it comes out that Yosef is the arbitrator of the purity of the actions of the brothers. And he decides that their actions are pure. What I explained this morning is that in each one of us there's a bit of Yosef and there's a bit of the brothers. We all descend, who knows who we descended from? We descended from them all. The families are mixed now. So we have within us, we have some Yosef and we have some of the brothers. And everything depends upon our view of God's involvement in our destinies. If we don't see, if we fail to see God's hand in our destinies, then we're taking our responsibility for our own destinies. Then we're saying we did it. And if we're taking responsibility for our own destiny, that goes all the way back to our decision to kill Yosef or to sell him to the Egyptians. If we're going to exclude the Ribbono Shel Olam from history, or we're going to exclude the Ribbono Shel Olam from the present, it doesn't make any difference. Once we exclude the Ribbono Shel Olam from events, then we have to acknowledge the possibility that he's excluded from any or all events. And if we're going to exclude the Ribbono Shel Olam from the events of our own lives and of our history, then we're going to exclude the Ribbono Shel Olam from that very first action too and say, who knows? Maybe the brothers took that decision on their own. And who are those brothers? It's us. We're the descendants of those brothers. In which case, we would have to take responsibility for that. And then look at the whole story. Who fires the first shots? The brothers sell Yosef. Was that God's will then? We've got to say no. Yosef goes down to Egypt. Paro responds to Yosef. Yosef saves Paro, and so it goes. But the whole thing wasn't God's will. If we're going to take responsibility for our own actions, then we have to take responsibility for that whole chain of history. And then when Achashverosh composes, or Amalek, or Haman compose this masterpiece of anti-Semitic literature, they've got what to base it on. It's history without God's divine interference and God's divine intention. It's the Jews acting themselves, and that we don't come out too good. But if we're going to accept that everything that we have comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam, if we're going to see God as the source of everything that we have, both good and bad, and that nothing that we do is really ourselves, and nothing that's happened to in our history is really ourselves, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam's hand is in all of our destiny, then we can have the right to say that too. Right at the very beginning, when the brothers decided to sell Joseph, to sell Yosef, that wasn't their decision, as Yosef himself says. That was Hashem's decision. That was Hashem's actions. He wanted it done. And therefore the whole course of events that follows that was all the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam as it goes through.
And so whether anti-Semitism is directed at us or at God depends on us, not on the anti-Semites. If we view ourselves as the masters of our actions, past, present and future, then when they criticize our actions, they're criticizing us. If we view ourselves merely as exponents of God's will and of agents of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then when they direct their hatred at us, they're directing it at the Ribbono Shel Olam. Whether the Ribbono Shel Olam will take out of Yosef by the brothers. And that really is the key to the way we view things. The ability to go right back to the source and to act accordingly. There's the lovely Medrash that we've often quoted with Yosef coming to save the Midianite girls, Yisra's daughters. He comes to the well and he chases away the shepherds, you'll remember. Moshe, sorry. And when the girls come home to their father Yisra, they say, there was an Egyptian man who saved us. And the Midrash says, was he an Egyptian? Moshe's not an Egyptian. Moshel le'echod shenoshchoy ha'orud v'hoyorot rat liten raglov b'mayim. A case where a man was bitten by a serpent and he went to wash his hands and wash his feet in the water in the river. The son of the Nair, he puts his feet in the water, v'roa tinek echod shushukea b'mayim, and he sees a baby drowning. V'sholach yodav yitzivah, he just stretches out his hand and he saves the baby. Omale ha'tinek, says that the baby or the father, ilule atok v'hayisi meis, if it weren't for you, I would be dead. Omale lo yani yitzalticho elo ha'orud shenashachti shenashachani v'rachti himeno hu yitzilcho. Don't thank me. I did what any person would have done. It was a reflex action. It wasn't even a moral choice. I saw you drowning, it was a reflex action to put my hand out and save you. That's not what saved you. What saved you was the serpent that bit me. That's what saved you. Kach omru bonus Yisrael Moshe, yeshukeichecho shitzatonim yadaroyim. So the daughters, when this was all over, the daughters of Yisrael said to Moshe, yeshukeach, thank you for saving us from the shepherds. Omru Moshe, yisrael mitzri shoharagti hu itzilischem. That was reflex action. Anybody would have done that. You come to a situation and you see somebody being persecuted, the natural human response is to sympathize with the persecutor. And just as if I was in the water and I would have seen a baby drowning, I would have picked the baby out of the water and saved the baby. So I saw you being persecuted, it came absolutely natural, it was reflex action that I saved you from the ruin. What you've got to be grateful for is that an Egyptian killed a Jew, and I saw it, and I killed, was beating up the Jew, and I saw it, and I killed the Egyptian, for which reason I had to run away from Egypt. That's why I'm here. So what you've got to be grateful for is not that I saved you. Any human being in my position would have saved you. You've got to ask, how come I was here at that moment? Just like the baby drowning in the river. He's got to realize, not that that person saved me, wonderful thing, you saved me. That's a normal thing, it's a reflex action. If you're going to want to say thank you to somebody, you've got to say thank you to the one who organized me to be at this point. Once I'm here, it's easy. Anybody would have saved you. The miracle is that I was here. That's the miracle. And we don't look that far. We just look at the immediate thing. Oh, you saved me. Thank you. That's as far as we look. There's nothing to say thank you for. Anybody would have done that. What you've got to question is, how come you were here at that very moment? How come the orud? A snake bit me. So go and say thank you to the snake. What does the Medrash mean? That the child has to go and find the snake and say, Shukar, thank you for biting the man, that saved me. That's not what it means. The snake also didn't make a moral choice. What was it, a decision? Did the snake think, I know there's going to be a baby drowning in that river. The only way I can save the baby is to bite the man, and he'll go down to the river, and that way he'll be able to save the baby. That's not what happened. What happened was, there was a Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam arranged for that man to be at that river, arranged for the snake to be bitten. That's what the Medrash means. That if you follow back, you come out to the first cause. If you follow back cause and effect, what caused this something, and what caused that something else, and what caused that? If you go back and further and further and further back, you have to come to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's where you've got to say thank you. And that's what Moshe says to these girls. Look how he teaches them Torah. Look how he's makar of them. He doesn't say, hey, come here, put on tefillin. I'll teach you how to say the brocha. He doesn't say that. That's not how he teaches them Torah. He doesn't say, come, Mashiach's coming, let's get ready for you. He doesn't say that. That's not how he does it. He teaches them what hakorah is, what it is. He's teaching them morality, he's teaching them ethics, he's teaching them a belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's starting with fundamentals. And he's teaching them from their own experience, not from books, from their own experience. You've just said thank you to me. So sit down for a moment. I want to explain something to you. You said thank you to me. Why did you say thank you to me? The Midrash just brings it in short, but we can imagine what that conversation really was. So why did we say thank you to you? Because without you, we would have been bullied once again. We might even have been killed. These shepherds were really, they're not nice people. And you saved us. We feel indebted to you. And Moshe must have said to them, do you really feel that indebtedness? Absolutely. And what does it make you feel? We'll do anything. How can we repay you? Is that the way you feel? He says to them, sure. And if I show you that it wasn't me, that it wasn't me, it was somebody else, would you feel the same way about the somebody else? Sure we would. So he tells them the story. So now do we have to go and be grateful to some anonymous Egyptian? No, he says, what you've got to realize is that this isn't a coincidence. That somebody arranged for me, I was a prince. What could cause a prince to be roaming around in the Midianite desert? A prince of Egypt from the house of Pharaoh. What could cause him to be roaming around at this moment to be here to save you? What could cause it? Somebody arranged for an Egyptian to be beating up a Jew while I was there. It was natural and normal for me to kill the Egyptian. That anybody would have done that. What was amazing was that it happened at that moment. That's what was amazing. And that I had to flee. What was amazing was that I happened to be here at this well at this moment. Just by chance, but there is no chance, young ladies. Everything is organized by the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ribbono Shel Olam. So he's been mekayem them. At that point, he's taken their natural morality and turned it into religion. And turned it into a belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam. And they go back and they tell Yisrael's story. An Egyptian man saved us. And Yisrael says, what do you mean an Egyptian man saved you? Well, there was an Egyptian man who killed a Jew. There was another Jew who was watching. And he killed the Egyptian. And So Yisrael must have said, so why are you thanking the Egyptian man? What's he going to do? What have you got to do with this Egyptian man? No, say the daughters. There's a Ribbono Shel Olam. Don't you realize this was all planned? There's a God who likes us. There's a God who takes care of us. There's a God who's Mashgiach who arranged for Moshe to be there at that time. That's what's amazing. And so then the Kalev Yisrael also that way. Look what he did, Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way he speaks to them. By going back to the very source and understanding what was the original cause of the chain of events which follow for centuries thereafter sometimes. Go right back to the serpent. Go right back to the snake and you'll realize that the origination of it all is something that is coincidental. And since we don't believe in coincidence, it's from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's where we've got to go to. And it's amazing how hard we find that. We'll go further back and further back and further back and further back, but to acknowledge that the Ribbono Shel Olam started it all off, that's hard for us because that obligates us. And that's why science will never discover God. They'll go on and on and on and they will make the most amazing theories to explain God away. And they'll be willing to believe these theories rather than to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because they can go back and back and back. But that first step of Bereshis Bara Elokim is such a moral obligation that science isn't willing to make that discovery. Any other discovery, yes, but not the discovery of God. Because the discovery of God affects the way I act. And no scientist is willing to be limited in the way he acts. He wants to be free. Because the moment he loses his freedom, he loses his professionalism. What kind of scientist are you if you're not free to think whatever you want? And that means the moment he discovers God, he's got to resign as a scientist. And he's not going to do that. Because science is his God. And he's not going to swap that God for another God. So he will go that far and no further. The world, Big Bang, evolved, all sorts of funny things. What happened? Most amazing things. Much harder to believe than Bereshis Bara Elokim. Much harder. But they'll rather believe that than to believe that Bereshis Bara Elokim. Let's take that one little step further. And that ties into the very beautiful talk that Rav Ezrachi gave in the Beis HaMedrash last night. He quoted the Medrash from our Sedra, where the Medrash says that the three gifts the Medrash refers to, wisdom, chokhmah, gvura, power, and osher, wealth, are all the most wonderful gifts through which one can acquire anything else in the world, provided the gift comes from Hashem. And he discussed what that means, the gift comes from Hashem, or doesn't come from Hashem. And at the end he said, provided we acknowledge that their source is the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in the process, he gave a lovely example and asked an interesting question. Where a similar story to the story with Moshe at the well occurred with Yaakov, you remember, when he landed up at the well. It's amazing how many of our forefathers found their wives at the well. And all you unmarried young guys, go to the well. But be prepared. Look what they do with the well. They do very, very heroic acts at the well. They're gallant. And can you imagine the Chayishiva Bocha today going to the well and acting so gallantly and chasing away these bullies to save the girls, to save the women? Is he going to do that? That's not the kind of thing we do nowadays. Yaakov goes and he comes to the well. Same story. The shepherd's there, and he lifts up the shepherds. Usually wait, you'll remember, until everybody arrives. And Chazal say why? Because the stone on the well was so heavy that you needed the entire team, all the shepherds, to come together to lift it up together, to lift the stone up together. If they weren't all together, it wasn't possible to lift the stone. And Yaakov comes and he lifts it up himself. And the Chazal say, like taking a cork out of a bottle, it was nothing for him. It was easy for him to do it. And the Chazal say, that the reason we're told the story is that we should know how strong Yaakov was. This isn't our general impression of a Yaakov, or of our Gedolim Yisrael, that they're that strong. That means that if Yaakov would have been competing in Barcelona at with the weights and things, he would have walked away with every gold medal. That's Yaakov. Yaakov's not a yeshiva bocher with his, you know, semi-hunchback, who can hardly say a boo to a cat, kind of lisping and pale as anything. So that wasn't Yaakov. Yaakov would have been able to walk away with every gold medal at the Olympics. It would have been nothing for him. Could have done a lot. That was Yaakov. Why is that important for us to know? So Rav Mizrahi said last night, we need to look at some other episodes where Yaakov was confronted with the need to use his strength. He was robbed on his way to that very well. He was robbed by Eliphaz. And Eliphaz took all his money, took all his possessions. He'd come with gifts for his future wife, and everything was taken away. So I asked Rav Mizrahi, why didn't he just give Eliphaz a clap? Look who we're talking about, a man who can walk away with any one of the gold medals. Why doesn't he give Eliphaz a clap and send him on his way? Well, he meekly says okay and hands over the goods. Why? And the way he treated Lavan, the same thing. Lavan runs in circles around him. Why didn't he beat Lavan up once and for all? That would have been the end of all the trouble. He would have had the wife he wanted. He would have had, wouldn't have had to work like that. All that trouble. If he was so strong, Lo Diakuko Shulyaku. The only time we find him using his strength is to save the girls, not to save himself. And Rav Mizrahi said, you see from there what strength is given for. Strength is not given for the promotion of oneself. Strength is given for chesed. And the posuk that the Medrash brings here, which he didn't quote last night, he should have, where the Novi says in Yirmiyahu, Ko amar Hashem, Al yithalel chochom b'chochmosoi. A wise person should not praise or find praise in his wisdom. The Al yithalel hagibur b'gevurosoi. And the powerful person should not find praise and glory in his gevuro. Al yithalel oshir b'oshroi. And a wealthy person shouldn't find praise in his wealth. Imagine what the world would look like. Al yishalel chochom b'chochmosoi, no Nobel Prizes. Al yishalel hagibur b'gvurosoi, no Olympic gold medals. Al yishalel oshir b'oshroi, and no ostentatious presentation of wealth. Ki im bezois yishalel hamishalel. So what does one praise? What is praiseworthy? Haskel v'yodoya, you see. If you're powerful, or if you're wealthy, or if you're clever, use that intellect to understand me. What? What about me? Ki ani Hashem oise chesed mishpot utzdoko ba'oretz. I'm clever, says Hashem. I'm rich and I'm powerful. And what do I do with it? I do chesed, mishpot, and tzedakah. Kindness, justice, and charity. Ki ve'eilech ofatzin um Hashem, because that's what I want. And that's what I've given you the power for. And that's what I've given you the strength for. And that's what I've given you the wealth for. And that's what I've given you the wisdom for. To use for others. To use for chesed. I didn't give it to you for yourself. And so Yaakov doesn't use it to save himself and his money from Eliphaz. And Yaakov doesn't use it to make his life easier with Lavan. Imagine what a temptation it must have been. How much Fadrus he could have saved by using his strength for that. He doesn't. Why not? Because Al Yishalel Gibur Bigvurosoi. That's not why I've been given this wealth. I've been given this wealth for chesed. I'll use it to save the shepherdesses, that yes. I'll use my strength for other people, but I won't use it for myself. It wasn't given to me to be used for myself. And Mr. David Tabak showed me the rest of the Medrash also, which Rabbi Zrachi didn't have a chance to develop last night, where it goes on and we see the same thing. Where the Medrash says, V'chein ata moitze b'vnei gad v'nei ru'uve. The same we find with Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. Shayu Ashirim, they were very wealthy. V'hoyolohim miknei godol, they had a lot of cattle. V'chidavu es mamonim, and they loved their money. V'yoshvu lohim chutz me'eretz Yisrael, and chose to dwell outside of Eretz Yisrael. L'fichach godol t'chilo mikol ha'shvotim, that's why they were the first to be exiled. U'mi gorom lohim. And what caused them to be the first to be exiled? What caused all this to them? Says the Medrash, not the way we normally explain it. They went in Eretz Yisrael, they were prepared to sacrifice living in Eretz Yisrael. Al shehifrishu atzmon min acheihem bishvil kinyonam. What was their argument to Moshe? The argument was, we've got cattle. It is in the interests of our wealth to be able to dwell in this part of the country. Fine, what's so terrible about that? They're right. It's a good economic decision. It's a good business decision. The difference is, the difficulty is, says the Medrash, and this was Ms. David Tabak's chiddush, and it's beautiful. The difference is, shehifrishu atzma min acheihem. They're separate from the rest of Klal Yisrael. How can they use their money to do chesed if they're not living among the rest of the community? That means they thought that the method of protecting wealth is through business mechanisms, through correct investment and so on, which is all very good. But if you trace the origins of your wealth to the Ribbono Shel Olam, go back to the serpent, go back to the Egyptian, where does it really come from? All the world, you've got wealth. Now you've got to decide what to do with it, how to protect it. So in order to understand that, start the story at the beginning. Don't do an Amalek. Amalek is the one who starts the story now. We have money. What shall we do now? That's where the story starts. It starts today. We have a problem. What's the problem? We've got money. Where do we invest it? That's not where you start the story. The story has to start from, why have you got money? Where does the money come from? Go back, go back, go back. Why have only you got it and others haven't? You don't know? Look in Yirmiyahu. You'll find out in chapter 9 of Yirmiyahu. Hashem says he's also got money. Chesed mishpot tzedakah ba'aretz. I want you to use that money to do chesed mishpot tzedakah. Ki be'eilei chafatzti. Because that's what I want. That's why I gave it to you. You're not going to protect your money by sitting aside from the community. The way you'll protect your assets is by using them for what they were given. Imagine these athletes that you see now in Barcelona, breaking world records, incredible, every year records broken and broken and broken. So I said once, ultimately the mile will have to be around, remembered in 0 seconds. How are they going to do it? I don't know, but every year the record is broken. Imagine a person who says, you come to the Olympics and there's the fastest runner, the strongest person, a person like Yaakov physically, with all that power, all that strength, and he's sitting there all muffled up, and you say to him, look, your race is coming, get ready. He says, I'm not running. I'm not doing anything. He says, what did you come here for? I'm protecting myself. You know, I've got these strong muscles, I've got to look after myself. Can't run. I haven't run for years. Why didn't you run for years? Because I've got to look after myself. We'll laugh at him. You've gone with sugar. Screw loose. Don't you realize the more you run, the stronger you get? Don't you realize the more races you participate in, the more records you break? Doesn't work the other way around. It's exactly the same with Chochmah. We know that. But I've got a good cop, so what am I going to do with my good cop? I'm going to sit at home and do nothing. Because Chas v'Shalom, I might use it and something might happen. And you never know, you know. It's like you've got a brand new car. You've just spent 250,000 Rand on the latest model Porsche. You lock it up. Very occasionally you take it out. Something might happen to it if you drive it. So you lock it up. Take your mind and lock it away. Something might happen if I start using it. We know that that's nonsense. So with wisdom we know the more you use it, the better it is. Works better. With strength we know the more you use it, the more you practice, the better it is. Comes to money, lock it away. Use it, it might go, it might disappear if you use it. Why? Why is that different to Chochmah? Why is that different to Gevurah? The three are all the same, they're put together in one posuk. It's there to be used, it's not there to be invested. It's there to be invested so that it can be used later on. It's there to be used all the time. For what? For Mishpat, Tzedakah and Chesed. That's what it's there for, it has no other purpose. Sometimes that's to be used for one's own family. Sometimes it's even to be used for oneself. Sometimes it's to be used for others. But its use should always be attached to mishpat, tzedakah, v'chesed. That's how you preserve wealth, not by locking it away. It's as absurd to try and preserve wealth by locking it away as it is to try and preserve strength by locking yourself away, or by trying to preserve wisdom by locking yourself away. It gets strengthened by using it, by doing business with it, by investing in a chesedika way where you're giving employment and you're building creatively and you're developing. All that is part of the way that wealth is built. And you're investing in direct tzedakah and in direct chesed and in achnosos ochim and all sorts of things. That's the way wealth is built. Not by locking it away. But for that, one has to be able to start the story at the beginning. If one looks at one's wealth, at one's possessions, and starts the story today or yesterday or the day before yesterday, it's not going to work. There's only one way we can understand what's happening to us. There's only one way we can give meaning to what's happening to us and thereby work out what's meant to happen and what we're meant to do with it. And that's by going right back to the very beginning. To Bereshis Bara Elikin. The Ribbono Shel Olam created a world. And everything that happened thereafter was all with the Ribbono Shel Olam's guiding hand. Everything with a purpose, everything with an intent. And if you start the picture at the very beginning and you see where you fit into that picture, all of a sudden things become very much clearer and one is able to understand what one's meant to be doing with the powers and with the assets that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. If we realize that these are matnos and lekim, if we realize that our talents and our gifts and our powers and our possessions are all given to us by the Ribbono Shel Olam, then we realize also the purpose for which they are given. That is the conflict between Yisrael and Amalek. Amalek is the man and the power and the force that chooses where to start the story. And he starts it where it suits him. That's where he starts it. Whether it's a political story or a philosophical story or an historic story or an artistic story, he starts the story where he wants to start it in order to make his point. Whereas the Jewish people start their story at the very beginning. And that's Pshat in the very first Rashi on Chumash. That's why the Torah doesn't start with the first mitzvahs. Because before you can start with any mitzvahs, you need to know one thing for absolute certainty. In the beginning, it was God who created Bereshis Bara Elokim.